Welcome to the Brookdale Community College Center for World War II Studies and Conflict Resolution podcast. This is podcast episode number one. In this podcast, we present part one of a two-part program featuring the 2006 Conflict Resolution Forum, The World of Islam, with guest lecturer Audrey Shabazz, a noted author and national representative of the Middle East Policy Council. Professor Shabazz gave two presentations during the forum, which we recorded on April 20, 2006, at Brookdale Community College's campus in Lincroft, Monmouth County, New Jersey. In this podcast, you'll hear her presentation on the history and culture of the Arab world. In the second podcast in this series, you'll hear her presentation on the world of Islam. Before we present Professor Shabazz's first talk, we spent a few moments with Professor Paul Zygo, director of the Center for World War II Studies and Conflict Resolution at Brookdale. We are talking with Paul Zygo, who is the director of the Center for World War II Studies and Conflict Resolution at Brookdale Community College in Lincroft, Monmouth County, New Jersey. And I have to, in the interest of full disclosure, mention that this is a broadcast reunion of sorts because more than 30 years ago, Paul and I worked together when I was a student broadcaster at the Monmouth College radio station, and he was doing a program called Speaking of Monmouth, and I did the production on that program for Paul. Paul, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, glad to be here, Sam. Glad to be working with you one more time, even though it's taken us 30 years to get together again.
Can you imagine? We are at the fourth annual Center for World War II Studies and Conflict Resolution Spring Conference. It's a forum on affairs of conflict resolution. Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, the Center for World War II Studies and Conflict Resolution was formed 5 years ago by a group of interested community members and college faculty members. And what we did was put together a center that would sponsor programs and services that would educate all people, but in particular the younger generation, about the impact of World War II and its legacy. Steve, one of the legacies of World War II is why can't we obtain peace via any other method other than aggression? And with all this being the case, we established what's known as the Conflict Resolution Forum, which we run on an annual basis. And what we explore are areas of conflict within the world, and we bring a group of people together to hear speakers talk about how we can arrive at solutions other than through aggression. That's the reason why this Conflict Resolution Forum is held on an annual basis.
The speaker is Professor Audrey Shabazz, who is a member of the Middle East Policy Council. Tell us a little bit about her presentation on history and culture of the Arab world.
She's going to speak about the history of the Arab world and its culture, something that I believe those who will be attending the event are really not aware of. We hear about Arabism. We hear about the Muslim faith. We hear about Islam. But do we really know what it's all about? Audrey will be addressing that, and following a discussion on the history of the Arab world and its culture, then she's going to zero in on the faith of that world, and that is the Islamic faith.
Now to our presentation. Audrey Shabazz has served as a presidential appointee to the Equity and Social Justice Committee and as chair of the International Human Rights Education Special Interest Group. The University of Pennsylvania has honored her work by awarding her their Janet Lee Stevens Award in 1992 for contributions to Arab-American understanding. She's the founder and director of the nonprofit organization Arab World and Islamic Resources, AWARE, in Berkeley, California. Ms. Shabazz has more than 22 years of experience teaching and creating curriculum about the Middle East and Islam. Her curriculum works include the Arab World Studies Notebook, the Arab World Notebook for the secondary school level, the Arabs, activities for the elementary and middle school, and a medieval banquet in the Alhambra Palace. Ms. Shabazz is listed in Who's Who in American Education, The World's Who's Who of Women, and the Dictionary of International Biography. Now, Audrey Shabazz's presentation on the history and culture of the Arab world.
I do whole-day staff developments, usually for county offices of education, state offices of education, school districts. And so if I address all of you as if you were entirely an audience of teachers, please forgive me. I want to start this morning with geography. And so we're going to take a look at this map that you all have a handout of. I found this map in the 1980s during the Iraq-Iran war, when for many of us it was trying to figure out what's the difference between Iraq and Iran, besides the fact that one ends in an N and one ends in a Q. But I thought this dilemma spoke very well to us as teachers. Again, forgive me if you're not a teacher. When we're asked to teach about a world region about which we don't have great familiarity. And this could well be because of events taking place over the weekend and on Monday morning we're expected to help our students figure it all out. I know if you were to put a map of the Far East or South America in front of me, I'd be hard-pressed to name all the countries in their appropriate locations. You'll quickly have your favorites on this map. Mine are I Rant and I Rave. That's because I was married for more than 30 years to a man from Irave. When he first immigrated to this country in the 50s to finish high school and go to college, if he told people the name of the country where he was from, he got a blank stare. But if he said the name of the city where he was born, Baghdad, he got kind of a knowing nod. I think in the 50s, that familiarity with Baghdad had more to do with the tales of the Arabian Nights than with actually being a real place. But I use this as a cue to myself to say something about how it is that I come to be here before you. I'm not of Middle Eastern background or origin, and my Iraqi husband always liked me to tell the story this way because he always wanted people to know that I was interested in him because I was first interested in the Middle East and not the other way around, which is what people might assume. It was actually social studies teachers that put me on the path that brings me here to you today. First and foremost, my seventh grade social studies teacher, that's where we got our first taste of world history. In most states, that's been shoved down to the sixth grade level. How about here in New Jersey? Sixth grade? Okay. Well, whatever that is, sixth or seventh grade, when you first learn about particularly those ancient Egyptians, aren't you just blown away? I was sure I wanted to be an archaeologist. I was sure that there was some tomb out there in the Valley of the Kings just waiting for me, like Howard Carter discovering the tomb of King Tut. And I read everything I could about the ancient Near East in the field of archaeology. I suppose that was appropriate for a seventh grade reading level. But I didn't become an Egyptologist. I did, however, twice take my seventh grade students to Egypt. And we had a little archaeological something that we were going to do while we were there. But it was another teacher at the high school level. It was my high school history teacher that got me interested in the modern Middle East. He taught a course called The Nature of the Non-Western World. Imagine that it's the 1950s, so I'm giving away my age. But there was a point during that year-long course where we had a substitute teacher for a whole week because our history teacher was called to San Francisco to explain himself before the House Committee on American Activities. Many of you have seen Good Night, A Little Luck, something. Those of you who are weren't around during that period, and his un-American activity was that he taught a course that informed people about the non-Western world. That cinched it for me. When I went to UC Berkeley, I majored in international relations. Out of the whole world, chose the Middle East as the region that I wanted to concentrate my studies in. And then within that region, having to choose a language, I chose Arabic as the language that would be my language of entree to understanding this world region. And that put me in a milieu where I was meeting people from the Middle East. And that's how I met the young man who became my husband. And again, he always wanted people to know that I was interested in him because I was already interested in Middle Eastern things and studying Arabic. I've always been on my own trajectory, my own path, because eventually along this long journey, I came to understand that Islam was the religious faith or the worldview that best described who I was, and came to recognize myself as a Muslim. And that had nothing whatsoever to do with that very long marriage to my Iraqi husband, because he happened to have been an Arab Christian. So I've always been on my own path, as it seems. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later on, but I want you to have an idea of how this developed. Let's look back at the map for a moment. If you pick up older works, particularly British works, they might use the term the Near East rather than the Middle East. Both of those terms, the Near East, the Middle East, are Eurocentric terms, aren't they? Yes. Near or middle to what? I think I figured that out as a kid growing up in California, because I never understood why the Far East was the Far East. If you're in California, it's the Near West, from a California perspective. And now we have a more inclusive term, and that is the Pacific Rim region has replaced the Far East, and California is part of that Pacific Rim. Those older works that might have talked about the Near East presented you with essentially this map, which is a map of the Fertile Crescent region. And some of us learned it that way in introductory geography courses. And the Fertile Crescent was defined by the river systems that aren't on this map, so I'll ask you to imagine them, the Tagus and Euphrates River Valley, the Jordan River Valley, and the Nile. That's what made that Fertile Crescent. But those of us in Middle Eastern studies would say that it is the second map that I have provided you with that is the Middle East. And I'm purposely putting, there are a lot of countries on this map that aren't Middle Eastern countries. I'm purposely putting Afghanistan and Pakistan out of view, although you'll see them on the map there in front of you, because they are generally not considered part of the Middle East. Maybe Pakistan, an Indian subcontinent grouping, Afghanistan perhaps belonging to Central Asia. But those of us in Middle Eastern studies would say this is the Middle East, that it stretches from Morocco in the west to Iran in the east, and from Turkey in the north to Sudan and Somalia in the south. So this is the Middle East, Morocco to Iran, Turkey to Sudan and Somalia. And this is the region that we're going to be looking at for the next few moments. I want to give you a way of understanding the people of the Middle East, but I want to juxtapose how we're going to look at the people of the Middle East against another possible way. And that's not to say that there are only two ways, but I wanted to call your attention to a document in California that defines what students will be learning in school from kindergarten to the 12th grade. It's our state framework. And it impacts all of you because textbook publishers are going to publish to what that California document wants. One out of three students in the United States is in California. Isn't that amazing? One out of three. That does include our college system as well. So we're a very populous state, we're a very young state, and we're the biggest textbook market. So textbooks are going to publish to what California wants, and pretty much the rest of us are stuck with it. That document was written by Charlotte Crabtree, an historian at UCLA, and Diane Ravitch, who went on to become an assistant secretary of education in the Bush senior administration. It was written in the late 1980s, but it's still in effect. So it's still having its impact. And when those of us in Middle Eastern studies saw that the Middle East section of it, when it was still in its draft form, we were absolutely aghast. Because they would have students studying about the Middle East by studying about one country that's a good guy and one country that's a bad guy, and that's all you needed to know. Move on to another world region. And it's only when we looked at the whole document that we saw we're not going to change their mind about this, because this is how they saw the whole world. So when you did Sub-Saharan Africa, when you did South America, Central America, the Far East, in every case, it would be singling out one country that's a good guy and one country that's a bad guy. Now, that represents a kind of Cold War mentality. It's the late 1980s, the Cold War is coming to an end, but that way of looking at the world, dividing it between our friends and our enemies, we would describe as a Cold War mentality. And once again, after a hiatus of about 12 to 15 years, we didn't use that kind of language. But now, once again, we find ourselves in a place where we are hearing that kind of language again. When it came to the Middle East, and I've never said, how about the rest of the world? So in the late 1980s, I guess the good guy in the Far East would have been Aquino in the Philippines and, you know, Somoza. When it came to the Middle East, what country do you suppose is the good guy? And this is pretty easy, even though it's small on the map. Israel. Okay, that's easy. Now, how about the bad guy? Basically, everybody else, right? Take your pick. Perhaps with the exception of Turkey, with whom we've had long-standing military alliances and troops on the ground. So Turkey's been a good guy, although recently the language about Turkey is not so good. And why? Why is Turkey coming off the good guy list? Because they wouldn't help us with our invasion of Iraq, okay? Crabtree and Ravitch actually chose Syria to be the bad guy in that document. And when those of us in Middle Eastern studies, when we saw we were going to move them away from this good guy, bad guy way of thinking, we said, well, why did you choose Syria? And to use your language, the opening sentence is that Syria is a representative Arab country. In which way do you regard Syria as being representative of the Arab world? And they said, well, Syria is representative because it's an oil-producing country. And which we had to tell them, no, Syria is not an oil-producing country. And actually, that wouldn't be representative, right? Most Arab countries don't have oil. They said, well, then, Syria is representative because it's an Islamic state. It's ruled by Islamic law. No, Syria is ruled by secular law, as are most of the regions in the world. So indeed, that makes them representative in that way. At the time, in 1989, there were three countries in the Middle East that claim they were ruled by religious law. And notice I'm emphasizing that word claim, that their adaptation represents their religious faith. And those three countries were Saudi Arabia, Iran, and Israel, but not Syria. So to tell you how much clout we academics have with people who are making political decisions that are going to affect education, they changed the word representative. The document now says Syria is there because it's an important Arab country, but it still has this list of horrendous things that you will learn about when you study about Syria. We're going to describe the people of the Middle East. We're not going to describe them as good guys and bad guys. Instead, we're going to let them describe themselves, and we're going to become listeners. And that's what authenticity is about. And that's what authenticity in the classroom is about. It's about making our classrooms a safe place where all voices can be heard and nurtured, particularly the voices of our students. So if we were going to look at the people of the Middle East, how they see themselves, I want you to know that for the last 200 or 300 years, with one modern exception, people of the Middle East have been defining themselves by the language that they speak, And with a shared language comes a whole set of shared cultural values. For each of these language groups, there's a unique history associated with that language group. So between their cultural values and their history, we could even begin to see that there's a worldview for each of these groups of people, a worldview that defines how they see themselves, how they see their neighbors in the region, how they see the rest of us in the world. So if we can have our students remember the simple acronym of a girl's name, Patty, P-A-T-I. Let me look up and make sure I'm on. Yeah. Okay. We'll know who the four major groups of people in the Middle East are. Now, this is people defined by the language that they speak. So P represents what group? Anyone? Persians. Okay? I used to sometimes hear Pakistanis or Palestinians for the P. No, those are not languages. And it gets easier after the P. A obviously is for Arabs, T for Turks, and I for Israelis. Now the first part of this is just getting our terminology straight. And so the next thing we would need to know is what is the language that gives each of these people their sense of cohesion and identification. So it's appropriate to say that the Persians speak Farsi, You may also say that the Persians speak Persian. The point being, these mean the same thing. And actually, among scholars who are doing their work in the English language, as I'm speaking to you in English, right now the preferred term is Persian. And honestly, those same scholars 10 or 15 years ago were trying to get us all to say Farsi. Now they want us all to say Persian. In the Persian language, they call their language Farsi. In English, we call it Persian. I think I had that sense that was what was going on because I knew that the Arabs call their language Lughat Arabiya. But we're not going to have any problem at all in saying that the Arabs speak Arabic. And the language of the Turks, Turkish. And the language that gives the Israelis their sense of cohesion and identification, what binds them together, Hebrew. And this is, remember I said, for the last 200 or 300 years, with one modern exception, Hebrew is that modern exception. Not that it's a modern language, but that it is used to build a sense of community and cohesion among people who came to Israel from all over the world, bringing a variety of languages, but that it was used to create a common sense of identity and bonding. That is a new use of Hebrew. Now, if you were to go back to a college or university, as I did, make the Middle East your area of interest and specialty, one of your first decisions would be, which of these languages will I study? Unless you have a real facility for languages, which I don't. Maybe you want to do all of them. For most of us, I think it's like picking one. And I hope that you can appreciate that by choosing a particular language, your expertise is going to become more narrowly focused. So when someone presents themselves to you as a Middle East expert, and that's something that I've never done, I've always had Arab world as part of whatever it is that I'm doing, so that you'll know that the tie is to the Arabic language. When somebody presents themselves to you as a Middle East specialist, and this is probably on the nightly news, someone will be interviewed, and underneath, across the bottom of the screen, it will say a consultant on Middle East affairs. You have a question to ask of that person. What language? Tell us where you're coming from. Which people can you best articulate their feelings, their concerns, their aspirations, their points of view in a particular conflict? Where are you coming from with what you're sharing with your audience? I actually only know of one scholar who does his work in all four languages, so can properly call himself a Middle East expert. Let me see if I can find his something prepared already with his website. If not, I'll put it up for you. And he's the only one that I know of. And I want to call your attention to his website because not only do Muslim students think that it's the best website on Islam, but international journals that maybe we'll talk about, outstanding websites, will say far and away this is the best of the best. And he is Dr. Alan Godless. He's at the University of Georgia at Athens, Georgia, and his website is www.arches.uga, that's the University of Georgia at Athens, .edu/tilde, and then his name, Godless. Does that all fit on there?
No.
Okay. Let's see. Godless. Okay. Here's a pop quiz for you already. I could call Alan at home and find out that actually this week he's not home. He's in Tehran. And if he's in Tehran, he's delivering a paper in what language? Farsi or Persian. But last week, by golly, or last month when I called his office, I found out that he was in Ankara. And if he was in Ankara, he was delivering a paper in
Turkish.
Every May, he takes his students out to Morocco, where the language he will be working in is Arabic, and he grew up as a youngster speaking Hebrew. So we could allow him to call himself a Middle East scholar or expert. In all humility, he would never do that. But he's the only one that I know of. So most of us have an expertise or a specialty on one of these language groups. Now, it's possible you might go to a large university, in which case you'll have other choices besides Persian, Arabic, Turkish, or Hebrew, because these are not the only languages that are spoken in the Middle East. And so here is where I want to change our acronym from PADI into PADIO. And the O is going to represent other, but as a good multiculturalist, I don't want to put a group of people in a category that says, refers to them as other. So we're going to just skip right over and talk about the other languages. Now, it goes without saying that everyone in the Middle East speaks at least one European language, and this usually has to do with their colonial experience. Or in the case of, say, Saudi Arabia, that had no colonial experience, it probably has to do with where they choose their students to send to seek higher education, in which case it would be the United States, and they would be English, no doubt, would be that second language. But we're not going to look at the European languages. We want to know the language that gives that person that sense of who they are, how they define themselves. So we're looking at the indigenous languages. And by the way, it's been my long experience in working with people from the Middle East that ordinary folk, you know, the taxi driver, the shopkeeper, the baker on the corner, actually speak several languages. These are multilingual people. And my own father-in-law, who was born in 1905, probably had the equivalent of an eighth grade education, but I'm not sure how much formal schooling he ever really had, spoke eight different languages. And so certainly Persian, Arabic, and Turkish were among them, and now I think you'll get a sense of a few more as we flesh this out. Well, we still have people in West North Africa who speak Berber, but what is the Iraqi language group that we hear about almost every day on the news? Kurdish, the language of the Kurds. An important Middle Eastern language group, I'm just going to move this up so you can see it. In California, we have a sizable community and a former governor, Duke Majan, and so that language group is Armenian. And then I wanted you to know that there are still people in the Middle East who speak Aramaic. It is not, as a professor of an introductory course that I took at UC Berkeley many years ago described Aramaic as a dead language. It is not a dead language. Can anybody tell me anything about Aramaic?
Dead Sea Scrolls.
Hmm? Dead Sea Scrolls, okay. Yes? Perhaps, has something to do with Hebrew and Arabic. Most people will know it as the language that Jesus spoke. So it was the lingua franca of the Holy Land, indeed the region in the first century of Christianity. If any of you saw Mel Gibson's The Passion, which I have not seen, but it was largely in Aramaic with English subtitles. It's the language that Jesus spoke. Linguists have long told us that it's the mother language out of which both Arabic and Hebrew developed. And then linguists gave a name to this language group. Aramaic, Arabic, and Hebrew, those were the Semitic languages. Now, these four groups of people who speak Berber and Kurdish and Armenian and Aramaic, they have something in common. What they have in common, obviously, is not language or even family of languages. What they have in common has to do with geography and most specifically to do with topography. You know what it is? Mountains. These are all people who live in mountains. So forget our stereotypes of Middle Eastern people and deserts. In fact, if you were to look at our map, let's look back at the map for a minute. Do you know that every Middle Eastern country has an outlet to the sea? There are no landlocked countries. And more people, Middle Eastern people, have made their livelihood from the sea than have ever lived in the desert as nomads. And yet, our very first introductory geography books at third grade or fourth grade, when we first get that sense of there's people outside of my neighborhood and my town and my country, those very first geography books start us off with these stereotypes, because those very first geography books will have a chapter called People of the Mediterranean. And in that chapter, you'll learn about the Spanish and the Italians and the Greeks. But all of these people are people of the desert. They're in a chapter called People of the Desert. Isn't that just look at the map? Okay. Now we're talking about neither the sea nor the deserts, but mountains. And the fact that these folk live in mountains helps explain how these old languages have survived. And that is, these languages have survived in isolation, right? Go out to the deep in the Appalachian Mountains, you'll find people doing things the way they were doing things 200 years ago on this continent. The isolation of mountains. And then we have to ask ourselves how these languages have survived what? Well, then let's do a little historic aside and say something about the 7th century. I don't really do history lectures, but I want to say something about the 7th century and how this ties in with language. In the 7th century, and that's where we can place the life of the Prophet Muhammad, those first Muslims who come out of the Arabian Peninsula, inspired by revelations to the Prophet Muhammad, and they are actually few in number, come out of the Arabian Peninsula. They settle amongst indigenous populations. They don't displace them. They settle amongst indigenous populations whose ancestors were the Pharaonic Egyptians, who built that great civilization, whose ancestors were Sumerians and Akkadians and Babylonians and Phoenicians and Canaanites and Philistines. And they bring with them two new ideas. They bring with them news of new revelations. We'll call that the religion of Islam. And they bring the Arabic language, which, even though it wasn't a new language in the 7th century, that was new to these folks. This was their introduction to the Arabic language. And we could color code that map of the Middle East in terms of where do we see people accepting or buying idea number one, the Islamic religion. Let's put that in a particular color. And we might do it in different points historically. Where do we see people accepting or buying idea number two, the Arabic language? So a whole group of people who adopted the Arabic language became Arabs in that process. They were Arabicized. Or we can say about that process that it was a process of Arabization. By casting off an older language, adopting the Arabic language. Now, if the Persians and the Turks had adopted the Arabic language, well, then we would just have two major categories of people up here, right? The Persians kept their language, the Turks kept their language, but you know, they did adopt something of Arabic, the Persians and the Turks. They didn't adopt the spoken language, but they did adopt the Arabic alphabet. So the Arabic alphabet becomes how the Persians write their language. The Arabic alphabet becomes the vehicle for writing the Turkish spoken language. These folks resisted that process of Arabization. Now, in that process of Arabization isn't something that just happened in the 7th and 8th centuries and was finished, but it's ongoing today. Ali Masruri, the Kenyan scholar who did that path-breaking series, The Africans, for PBS a number of years ago, has written a short essay called The Arabization of Africa as an ongoing process. So this word, Arab, more than the other words that we put up here, really does not give you a clue as to the person's race or, there's another word I haven't even used yet, religion. Okay, we haven't talked about religion yet. People became Arabicized, and our media doesn't get it at all. And two places where our media is confused about this process of Arabization. One has to do with the Sudan, where what's going on in the Sudan gets quite a different coverage in the world's press, even in the BBC, than in the United States. Our press covers the Sudanese crisis as Arabs in the north are oppressing black Africans in the south. Right? Okay, I got it? That's your sense of what's happening in the Sudan? Now that you know something about the process of Arabization, would you like to hazard a guess as to the skin color of the Arabs in the north of the Sudan? They are black Africans. So what we have in the Sudan is we've got black Africans in the north of the Sudan oppressing black Africans in the south of the Sudan. What creates the differences between them? Language. Language becomes how we describe ourselves. This is who we are, and you're not us. This makes you distinct. You know, how else can we understand when we teach U.S. history and we get to the point when we're looking at the slave trade and our students come to a recognition that black Africans enslaved black Africans, and we go, oh, wow, how could they do that? Perfectly easily. If your whole world is composed of black people, you have no sense that you're a black African. Black Africans in the south of the Sudan would never describe themselves as black Africans. They would describe themselves by the language that they speak. I'm Dinka, or I'm this, Dinka being the major language. White Europeans don't think of themselves as one great white European race. White Europeans go to war with each other, have no problems killing each other based on what? Language, and all that language instills in you, a sense of who you are, and that they're not us, that's another group. Arabization. But when we hear Arabs in the north of the Sudan oppressing black Africans in the south, is it by design? I don't know. I won't go there. But we get the idea that this is a racial conflict, because when we hear Arab, we're thinking about what Osama bin Laden or the King of Jordan or Hosni Mubarak of Egypt. We're thinking of that olive-complected person and do not understand the process of Arabization. And the other place where our media doesn't get it is when it reports what's going on in Iraq. We're told that in Iraq there are three groups of people. Who are they? Kurds and Sunnis and Shias. How come I haven't put Sunni and Shia up here? Because those terms are religious terms. How about Kurd? Is that a religious term? No, that's about language. So we got some, that's apples and oranges then, telling us that there are Kurds and Sunnis and Shias in Iraq. So we have a couple questions to ask. Who are the Sunnis and Shias? How do I find them up here on what I've laid out for you? When our media is talking about the Sunnis and Shias in Iraq, it's talking about the Arabs, right? Iraq is an Arab country, is a member of the Arab League. Most of the people in Iraq are Arabs. It means they speak Arabic. And if we consider the Arab population of Iraq, the Shias outnumber the Sunnis. Okay, so we can say there's two groups in Iraq, Arabs and Kurds, two major groups, Arabs and Kurds. There are Armenians and Aramaic-speaking people as well. But two major groups, Arabs and Kurds. Or if we want to talk about them in religious terms, then what do we need to know about the Kurds? What religion are they, right? Kurd only tells you what language that they speak. Does anybody know what religion the Kurds are? They're Muslim. Now which one? Sunni or Shia? They're Sunni. They're Sunni Muslims. So Kurds are Sunni Muslims, so we could say there are two groups in Iraq. If we want to talk about them in religious terms, there are Sunnis and Shias. And when we add the number of Kurds to the mix, then the Shias don't so greatly outnumber the Sunnis. It's beginning to look more like 60-40. Okay? 60% Shia, 40% Sunni. Now, so our media doesn't get that either. And I do want to say one thing about Iraq. This is a very, and I don't want to use this word in an old way that said something about their level of development, but I want to say tribal, and I want to say it's a very tribal society. By that I mean family and clans. How they, you know, you could think of the Bushes as a tribe or the Kennedys as a tribe, right? Okay, in that sense. So it doesn't work. If the Shias want greater representation in Baghdad, in the government, that is a reflection of their numbers in the country, it doesn't work for the Bush administration to put someone in charge who is nominally a Shia. That's not going to appease the Shia population, because they know who their major families are. They know who the important families in the Shia community it's about. This has more to do with family than it has to do with theology. It's about family. And they need to see those families you know, a representative of those families in that government, or they will feel that they're not enfranchised. They will feel they've been disenfranchised. And so we don't get it. We don't get it that this is really about family and clan, and much less to do with, certainly to do with theological differences. But while we're on that, why don't we talk about, well, we're going to get to religion in a moment. Now, I have had teachers use this schematic, Patty and Patio, as vehicles for developing courses of study, certainly units of study, because there's all kinds of things that we could do that we're not going to do today. We could look at the different folktale traditions of each of these language groups. We could look at the different literary traditions of each of these language groups. I will sometimes have a high school world literature teacher come to a program hoping to identify a piece of Middle Eastern literature that could be incorporated into a high school world literature course, and then I've made that person's decision more difficult, haven't I? Because now they understand there's lots of Middle Eastern literature for each of these language groups. Whose literature? We could look at the different musical traditions of each of these groups, different music, different cuisine. That would be a delicious thing to do, and probably here in New Jersey you have an opportunity to investigate all these different cuisines. What the earth is going to produce is going to be the same because it's the same climatic region, and it's going to be the same ingredients that we're going to find in Spanish and Italian and Greek food. And I think you have a sense that those are unique cuisines, right? Spanish, Italian, and Greek. Likewise, the whole rest of the Mediterranean are going to be unique cuisines for each of these groups. And then maybe the most important thing that we could look at is the distinct history of each of these groups. And that would go a long way in helping us understand how they see themselves, how they see the neighboring countries, how they see the rest of us in the world, their unique history. Consider just for a moment the importance of the Holocaust in defining how Israelis see themselves, their neighbors in the region, the rest of us in the world. Did the Holocaust take place in the Middle East? No, it took place in Europe. Makes my case all the more poignant to understand how history, the role it plays in having people identify themselves and their neighbors. Each of these people has a unique history. I would just like to do two more things quickly with this, and then I'm going to be done. But I've got to look at my, see how we're doing on time.
We're a little bit, we're about just a couple minutes beyond, but
okay.
Maybe
shortcut. All right. This is going to be the shortest thing I've ever done. Can we identify countries with these language groups? Now here, can we find them on the map, in other words? We can, but with a big proviso. People who speak a particular language are not necessarily going to fit within the neat, tight boundaries of a nation state, particularly if they didn't have any say in deciding what those boundaries were going to be, if those boundaries were decided by outside colonial powers. And this is going to be the case not just in the Middle East. This is going to be the case in sub-Saharan Africa, South America, Central America, the Far East. I want to give you one example of how these boundaries got drawn, and it's the boundary in East Africa, the boundary between Kenya and what was in colonial times Tanganyika. In the 1960s, Tanganyika gets its independence, forms an alliance with the island of Zanzibar, and becomes the modern nation of Tanzania. Kenya was ruled by which European power? Anybody know? The British. Tanganyika was ruled by Germany. You know, this is the sub-story of that great Hollywood film, The African Queen, right? Bogart and Hepburn, Charlie and Rose, are trying to get from a part of German-controlled Africa, trying to get to a part of British-controlled Africa. And the setting for The African Queen is the First World War. I want to take you back earlier to Queen Victoria's time. Queen Victoria of England. She sees looming on her social calendar the birthday of Kaiser Wilhelm I of Germany. And Queen Victoria is wondering what to give her cousin Willie for a birthday present. Now, how is the Kaiser the first cousin to the Queen of England? Because the English royal family are not English. That's a German family. That at a certain Point takes the name Windsor to legitimize why they are ruling over English people. Okay. He is her cousin. He's also her brother-in-law because Victoria is married to that dashingly handsome German prince, Prince Albert. Well, she finally figures out what to give him for a birthday present. She calls in her map makers. She has them make a little zigzag in what was otherwise a straight line boundary so that she can put something on the Tanganyika side of the border. And what does Queen Victoria give to the Kaiser of Germany? How about the highest mountain on the continent of Africa? She gives him Mount Kilimanjaro. Well, do you think that the Brits sent anybody out there to ask the people on Mount Kilimanjaro where they felt they belonged? Or the people who lived around the base of Mount Kilimanjaro? Of course not. And this is how these boundaries got drawn. So once we understand that, then we can say, okay, to some degree, we can match these languages with boundaries, but it's not going to be an exact science. When we think of Persians and the Persian language, we can think of the country of Iran. For Arabs, we've got 21 or 22 countries stretching from Morocco to Iraq and from Iraq and Syria in the north to Sudan and Somalia in the south. For the Turks, it's Turkey. And for the Israelis, it's Israel. And then the one last thing I want to do is how many people are we talking about? How many people are we talking about? Well, for Persians in the country of Iran, about 60 million people. For the Arabs in those 21 or 22 countries, 290 million people. For the Turks in Turkey, 66 million. And for the Israelis, as speakers of Hebrew, 4 million. And this gives us for the whole Middle East a nice round number of 420 million people in the Middle East. Okay, there we got our numbers. 420 million. 60 million Persians in Iran, 290 million native speakers of Arabic, 66 million Turks, 4 million Israelis. Let's take a break, and when we come back, we're going to look at these numbers in a more visual way and move to something we haven't talked about yet, which is Islam.
And that will conclude this first podcast in the Brookdale Community College Conflict Resolution Forum series. Be sure to listen to podcast number 2 when Audrey Shabas will speak on the world of Islam. Our thanks to Professor Paul Zygo, Director of the Center for World War II Studies and Conflict Resolution at Brookdale, for his cooperation in the production of these podcasts. If you have comments about the podcasts, please send an email to Steve, S-T-E-V-E, at lubetkin.net. That's lubetkin.net. For more information about the Center for World War II Studies and Conflict Resolution at Brookdale, please visit the website at www.brookdalecc.edu/FAC/TLT/WW2. Our theme music for this podcast is Le Funambule, a composition by the Canadian band Katyar, which comes from Montreal. You can find out more about Katyar at garageband.com. For Audrey Shabas, Paul Zygo, and everyone at the Center for World War II Studies and Conflict Resolution at Brookdale Community College, this is Steve Lubetkin. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you out there on the net. Take good care.